No news is good news. How many of you have said or heard that in this last week? That's a phrase we hear all the time. Whenever we expect the worst, silence can be our best friend. No middle of the night phone call, no banging on the door waking us up to news we really don't want to hear. The problem is, there's always news. I mean, every morning newspapers roll off the presses. Every afternoon and evening there is the network news. Every hour on the hour, radio stations air the news. And you've got some radio and TV stations that are nothing but news. And it's usually not good news, is it? Think about the headlines on the newspaper or the lead stories of the evening news. What are they usually talking about? Some kind of disaster, death, some discouraging report about the nation's economy or health or bad weather even captures the headlines. Violence, corruption, suffering. These are the things that tend to dominate the news. Even the commercials for the nightly news tend to highlight some horrible event with the phrase, details at 10. When was the last time you heard some really good news in the newspaper or on a news report? Was it on the front page or the beginning of the broadcast, or does it tend to be relegated to the back pages and maybe the very last thing that is aired? Now, I know some stations have made a conscious effort to report positive stories at some point of their telecast, but if you average it all out, the percentage of good news to bad news remains pretty small. Well, I got some more bad news for you. It's always been that way. I don't know that times are really getting any worse. Ever since the dawn of time, when sin entered the world through the rebellion of our first parents, our world has been filled with disaster, disease, destruction, and death. Now, and why is that? It's because that for all of our advancements, for all the technology that we come up with, human nature really hasn't changed all that much. We're still very much at our core selfish, demanding, and willing to do whatever it takes to have what we want regardless of who or what gets in our way. And that's what makes the Bible and this little book of Habakkuk in particular so relevant for our day and age. When the prophet cried out at the beginning of his book, "Destruction and violence are before me, there is strife and conflict abounds. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. The law is paralyzed, justice never prevails." It's like he's reading our own newspapers. Because again, human nature hasn't changed all that much. Now as we turn into chapter 2, in that passage which Sandra read for us earlier, we see a more detailed account of the sins of that day and age. Habakkuk had wondered to God, "Why don't you do something about my people, the people of Judah? They're so ungodly, they're so corrupt, they're so violent and wicked." God said, "I am doing something. I'm going to send the Babylonians to teach them a lesson." And Habakkuk said, "Now wait a minute. The Babylonians are worse. They're more wicked, more corrupt, more violent, more vile." And this is God's response to Habakkuk, which in essence says, I know how bad they are, and I'm going to do something about it. And we see here a detailed account. And what we discover is that the atrocities of the ancient world sound vaguely familiar to our ears because it's what we read in the papers every day. You see, the news isn't all that new. And it isn't all that good either. In Habakkuk chapter 2, we see an appalling report of what was happening in Habakkuk's own day. And in these verses, the prophet condemns five specific practices common in that day. Now, I'd like to borrow Warren Wiersbe's phrases in outlining these five. You have first the peril of pride. Secondly, the curse of covetousness. Thirdly, the error of exploitation. Fourth, the dangers of drink. And fifth, the ignorance of idolatry. And I'd like to take time and look at each of these practices, which Habakkuk saw in his own day, and I think we don't have to look too hard to see in our own day as well. The first is the peril of pride. You go back to verse 4, combining it with verse 5, we read this, "See, he is puffed up," and he's speaking here of the Babylonian. "His desires are not upright. He is arrogance and never at rest." Arrogance, pride, that picturesque phrase, puffed up, meaning they're full of themselves. We think of a balloon being filled with hot air, and that describes an awful lot of proud people, doesn't it? And pride has a way of puffing us up so that we have a false estimate of ourselves. I love the way Wiersbe puts it. He says, "Some Christians grow and others just swell." And that's true. Some people just, they have a swelled head. You've got to widen the doorway so that they can get into a room. Now, I believe that the placement of pride at the beginning of this list is not an accident. When Solomon listed the seven sins that God hates in Proverbs chapter 6, guess what the first one of the list was? Pride. I believe that the root of all sin is selfishness, and pride exalts self above everything else. I agree with C.S. Lewis when he wrote, "There is one vice of which no man in the world is free, which everyone in the world loathes when he sees it in someone else, and of which hardly any people can ever imagine they are guilty of themselves." I do not think I have ever heard anyone who was not a Christian accuse himself of this vice. And at the same time, I have very seldom met anyone, again, who was not a Christian, who showed the slightest mercy in it in others. There is no fault which makes a man more unpopular, no fault which we are more unconscious of in ourselves. And the more we have it in ourselves, the more we dislike it in others. The vice I am talking about is pride. According to Christianity, the essential vice, it is the utmost evil. Anger, greed, drunkenness, all that, they're all mere flea bites in comparison. It was through pride that the devil became the devil. Pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. And that's what we have in our culture today. We have this growing anti-God sentiment, don't we? We want to take God out of everything. We've taken God out of our schools. We've taken God out of our courthouses. Pretty soon they're going to take God out of our money as well. In fact, I think somebody had it right when they said it would be accurate if they would just add the word "this." In this God we trust. We have this growing sentiment to remove God. Why? Because we think we are supreme. We believe that mankind is the answer to whatever the questions are in life. And that is nothing short of pride. And as we go through this list of all of the other sins, you're going to see that all of these sins find their root in pride. I am number one. I am the greatest. I am the most important. And it is the worst sin. It is the chief sin. Pride makes us greedy. Pride leads us to exploit others for our own gain. Pride drives us to self-indulgence. Pride drives us to violence when we don't get our way. And yes, pride even leads to idolatry, which we will see when we get there. So the perils of pride is a sin that Habakkuk decries in this passage. The second woe that Habakkuk pens concerns the curse of covetousness, which is another word for greed. You know, in our day and age, we are told greed is good. He who dies with the most toys wins. But what did Jesus say? Jesus said in Luke 12:15, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." Wow, does that run counter to our culture? I mean, that would bring capitalism to a screeching halt if people believe that. We got to have more. We got to have the newest. We have to have the best. Now, don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with having and enjoying nice things. James tells us in James 1:17, every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father. Paul writes in 1 Timothy 4:4, everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving. Now, I know a lot of people think that 1 Timothy 6:10 says money is the root of all evil. That's not true. That's misquoted. It says the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. And it's that love of money is what greed is all about. That's the curse of covetousness. So it's not about having nice things. The problem with greed is that instead of us owning things, things own us. That's when it becomes a sin. That insatiable desire for more will drive us to obtain wealth even in dishonest ways. According to Ephesians 4:28, there's three ways you can get wealth. You can work for it, you can receive it as a gift, or you can steal it. Three ways of getting it. Now, we know stealing is wrong. In the Ten Commandments, it says, "Thou shalt not steal." And yet, when you open your newspapers and when you listen to the evening news, how much do you hear about people embezzling, about people appropriating for themselves what's not really theirs? And we're even seeing in our part of the country, home invasions and robberies and burglaries are on the rise as people are desperate to have it and they want it now, and so they'll take from other people. Now, that might be news in Central Illinois, but it's not really news. It's been going on a long, long time. It's the curse of covetousness. And whenever you have a people that specializes in greed, robbery, and extortion as a means of acquiring whatever their hearts desire, they'd better look out for the interest God will take from them when He rectifies the manner. Habakkuk writes in verse 7, "Will not your debtors suddenly arise? Will not they wake up and make you tremble? Then you will become their victim." It's very interesting, that word for debtors or creditors, it comes from the Hebrew word meaning to bite. And what's Habakkuk saying? You who devour others, it's going to come back and bite you. And we've got to be careful when we allow things to become too important. We must be on our guard against greed. You know, we mentioned the 8th commandment, thou shalt not steal, but you know where it all starts? It starts with the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet. Because it all begins with the desire, it all begins with the greed, and then it leads us to the action. We need to nip it at the source. Habakkuk 2:12 through 14 deals with a third practice, the error of exploitation. Somebody once quipped, "Godly people love people and use things. Greedy people love things and use people." And greed often leads to exploitation. You say, what do you mean by that? Well, you exploit somebody when you take more than you give. When you treat people like things. You exploit people when they have to work harder for you than you would work for them. You exploit people when you make people do things you wouldn't do yourself. So you see a great deal of exploiting is going on today. But again, that's not new. It was happening back in Habakkuk's day as well. The Babylonians had done more than humiliate the nations they had conquered. They completely defiled the land. They destroyed the forest so that they could have lumber They went through Lebanon and took down all the cedars for themselves and left nothing in their wake. Now, I know it's only in comparatively recent years that the importance of conservation has been understood. But here Habakkuk is even judging, pronouncing woe on the Babylonians because they were not careful even of the environment. They were exploiting nature as well as human beings. And God says, I will bring everyone to account for that. And so you see this snowball effect. You begin with pride, which leads to greed. And the greed leads to exploitation. And this leads to our next woe, the dangers of drink. With astonishing clarity, Habakkuk put his finger on one of the weaknesses of the typical Babylonian. He was addicted to alcohol. You think drinking was a problem now? It was a problem then as well. And the Babylonians had a real, real problem with this. Now, it's true that war was his trade and even his passion, but it was wine that was his downfall. If you read in Daniel chapter 5, that when Babylon fell, do you know what was going on at the time? The king and all of his leaders were in a drunken bash. They were all smashed, and here comes the invading army. They really had no business defeating Babylon, but they caught Babylon unaware, caught him unprepared. Why? Because they were too busy partying and having a good time. You know, it may surprise you to learn that alcohol is America's number one drug problem. We don't often think of it that way, but that's exactly what it is. When you read in the newspapers about people who are being picked up for using cocaine and marijuana and meth and all these other drugs, just remember the number one drug problem in the United States is alcohol. Between 11 and 17 million Americans are considered to be alcoholic. Americans spend about $50 billion a year on alcohol. You know, people complain about the amount of money that's spent on military weapons or programs for the poor. We spend $50 billion a year on alcohol. You say, well, yeah, okay, people make money from it. It's a business. That's true. But alcohol problems cost the American economy an estimated $68.6 billion each year through lost work, through health costs that rise, accidents on the highway. Do you know that the leading cause of mental retardation is mothers who abuse alcohol during pregnancy? Do you know that more than 250,000 Americans lost their lives in alcohol-related accidents in the last 10 years? That's 25,000 a year. You break that down, one person dies every 21 minutes in an alcohol-related wreck. That's about 70 a day. On an average weekend night, it is estimated that one out of every 10 drivers is driving drunk. Alcohol consumption is the leading cause of death for persons between the ages of 15 and 24. 83% of all fire fatalities are alcohol related. Between 50 and 68% of all drownings are alcohol related. Up to 80% of suicides are alcohol related. An incredible 86% of all murders are alcohol related. You know, the news reports a lot about child abuse, and they should. It's something that needs to be exposed and known about. But did you know that 65% of child abuse cases are connected with alcohol? And that on average, 200,000 Americans die each year, either because of their own or somebody else's alcoholic consumption. Now, the Bible does not demand total abstinence. The Bible decries drunkenness, and that's what's being discussed here in Habakkuk. But how much does it take for a person to become drunk? And that answer varies from person to person. You know, the state legal limit to drive is 0.08 blood alcohol level. But how much is that? Alcohol is metabolized differently in every person. We've got to be careful. And again, I'm not saying that it's wrong to take a drink, but it is wrong when the drink takes you. It is wrong to be drunk. It is a sin. And it is dangerous, as we see every day and every night in our news. Now, unfortunately, drunkenness is rarely a solo sport. Look at verse 15. Habakkuk writes, "Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbors, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk." Why? So that he can gaze on their naked bodies. It's not enough for a person to drink. We want others to drink with us. We want other people to get around us and drink. Why? So that we can have a good time. I've heard people say, you can't have a good time without alcohol. Really? But what usually happens when people have too much alcohol? Don't ask them. They won't remember. But it leads to all other forms of exploitation and immorality. See, they're not only seeking personal gratification, but they're exploiting others as well. And now you can enter in not only the dangers of drink, but you can bring in other industries in our culture, such as pornography, gambling and drugs, all these things where we're not only doing it ourselves, we're trying to get others to do it with us. And for some, it's purely financial. They're going to benefit from it one way or another. For others, it's so that we can make fun of somebody else and enjoy them because they can't walk a straight line and they're talking all slurred and we think it's hilarious. God says, woe to people who give to others to get drunk so that we can gaze at them and look at how stupid they are. As Jerry White puts it, we live in an age of freedom of expression and freedom of lifestyle. X-rated movies and magazines are available in every city and all over the internet. Legislation to control pornography has failed in most places. The sexual fiction of yesterday is the reality of today. Fewer and fewer teenagers leave high school as virgins, and if they do, they're ridiculed on the way out the door. Primetime television flaunts homosexuality and infidelity. Have you noticed a rise in that lately? It's there. It's like Paul writes in Romans, not only do they engage in these things, but they applaud others who do the same. Habakkuk says, be careful. Woe to people who do these things. And finally, Habakkuk denounces the ignorance of idolatry. Now, according to the Old Testament, Babylon was the home of all idolatry. There it had its roots. There it had its rise. And it spread from there to all over the world. Now, I'm sure some of you are saying, phew, at least there's one thing we don't have to worry about in our day and age. Not so fast. Idolatry is all around us. You say, okay, what are you talking about? You must not be talking about bowing down to some, you know, image of wood or metal, because we don't do that today. No. Idolatry is worshiping and serving the creature instead of the creator. An idol is a substitute for God. When you know the true and living God, you don't want substitutes. But those who have rejected God, they've got to fill that void with something. And they fill it with something either that they make or they themselves. And that's why I say that idolatry is ignorant. Just think about it. In idolatry, a person makes the image and then they bow down to it. Habakkuk was saying, how stupid for you Babylonians. You create this statue and you expect it to answer your prayers. You made it. And this is true today. We have idols all around us. Now again, they may not look like statues, but they can be a career. They can be a car, they can be a house, they can be money itself, it can be another person. It's anything that is foremost in our lives. Do you want a checklist? Do you want to know if you have idols in your life? Answer these questions. There's the devotion test. For whom are you working and living? There's the dependence test. Who or what do you trust? When difficulties come, where do you turn? That may be your God. There's the delight test. What gives you the most pleasure? There's the decision test. What guides you the most when you make decisions? And then there's the destiny test. What are you really looking forward to? If we answer with anyone or anything besides God in those questions, we're guilty of breaking the first commandment, which says, I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. If anything takes God's place in our lives, we are guilty of idolatry. And when you think about it, that is sheer ignorance. Why would we let anything replace the living God in our lives? So we have these five woes. Sins that were being committed by the nation of Babylon, and God pronounced judgment upon them for their sins. The interesting thing is, though, some of these same sins were taking place in the nation of Judah as well. Some of these same things Habakkuk complained about a chapter earlier. We might fall into the trap of wanting God to judge the sins of others, but not so much our own sins. We might look around and say, you know what, God, you need to do something about that. Look at these wicked people. They're terrible. We need to look in a mirror, too, because we're not much better. It's very easy to be convicted about other people's sins and ignore our own. So let's not get too high and mighty here. We have met the enemy and he is us. Now, I want to mention briefly an absolute retribution outlined by God through the prophet Habakkuk. You see, not only did God point out these crimes that were being committed, but he said, I'm going to do something about it. Habakkuk complained that, God, you're not doing anything about all this evil. God says, I'm doing something about it. And so with each one of these sins that are detailed here, God promises Habakkuk that he would turn the tables on the wicked. And you go down through and you'll notice it's that basic law of life that you reap what you sow. When the Babylonians thought they were all that and they were secure and nobody could defeat them, God said, I'm going to bring you down. When you go to the heights of pride, I'm going to humble you to the depths of defeat. When they were greedy and they were exploiting others, and we didn't get into the details, but back then they took things by two ways. One of it was just by sheer force. They took what they wanted, but they also used extortion. They would charge exorbitant interest on loans in order to make all this money back, and God says, I'm going to pay you back with interest. What they reaped, they were going to sow. When they got other people drunk to glory in their shame, God said, you're going to get drunk on my cup, the cup of wrath, and the shame is going to be turned on you. Time after time, God says, what you sow, you're going to reap. Get it right. And then that last one about the idols. You make the useless idols, you're going to become useless. You become just like the thing that you worship. And if you rely on things that are dead and cannot help you, you're going to be helpless. It's all going to be turned around. Now, against this dark background of judgment and wrath, the wrath of God leveled against these awful sins, we do have three very wonderful assurances. First is the assurance of God's grace. Remember the message from last week. The just shall live by faith. God is not going to destroy everybody. He tells Habakkuk, there will be a remnant who live on through their faith. God does not wholesale wipe out everybody. Those who have their faith in God, they will live on. So we have the assurance of God's grace. Secondly, we have the assurance of God's glory. In verse 14, in the midst of all this bad news, Habakkuk breaks in with a breaking story of good news. He says, the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. God tells Habakkuk, one day things are going to be right. One day all these injustices are going to be taken care of and it's going to be good. God's glory is coming. Now, as we saw last week, we need to be patient. We need to wait for it. But it is coming. There is light at the end of the tunnel. And then finally, we have the assurance of God's government. Verse 20, the Lord is in His holy temple. The Lord is on the throne. The Lord has not abandoned ship. The Lord is still God. He is still on the throne. He is still in control. What does that call us to do? We are to be submissive. It says, let the earth keep silence before Him. Don't argue. Don't try to tell God what to do. God is in heaven. He's on the throne. He's caring for His own. He knows what He's doing. We can have that assurance. Little bit of good news amidst all the bad. And that brings us to my final point, which is an appropriate response to God's revelation. The Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before Him. The original Hebrew here, it's an imperative. It's a strong word. It's like our word, hush. Hush. Be still. Be quiet. We are in the presence of the Lord. Now, I know that sometimes that chorus that we sang is used to set our minds in a proper place for worship. But think of the context in which Habakkuk wrote this. This is in the context of judgment. Think instead of a courtroom. Maybe it's a courtroom where a high-profile murder case has been heard, and the jury has returned a verdict of guilty. And now the date has been set for the condemned to be sentenced. So imagine in this courtroom, there's all kinds of people. There's the victim's family and friends. There are curious onlookers. There's lots of reporters. And of course, they're all talking at the same time. So you have this courtroom. But all of a sudden, the bailiff walks in and says, "All rise. This court is now in session." And immediately there is silence. As the judge walks in and is about to pronounce his sentence. That's the context of what Habakkuk is talking about here. And I think if there's a lesson for us to take from this passage, it is to acknowledge that the judge is on the throne. And while we are witnesses to all of the evil that is going on in our world, when we look around and we hear and we read all the bad news, all of this that's going on, it is tempting for us to maybe become proud. Thank God I don't do those things. To become judgmental. Let me, Adam. I'll take care of it. Or to become skeptical and cynical. God, why aren't you doing anything? The appropriate response is to allow God to be God. To be silent in His presence and allow Him to work out His will in His timing. I'd like to conclude with a story of one of the English reformers named John Bradford. One day he was out in the streets of England and they were leading a condemned criminal to the gallows to die. And that was a very public thing back then, and people lined the streets and they were pelting this man with insults and catcalls and probably a few tomatoes and eggs, if you know how that goes. They were having a great time watching this condemned criminal be led off to die. Away with him! String him up! We'll be better off without him. All except one man, John Bradford, who at the time was a preacher, known as a man of God. Bradford lowered his head and muttered to himself as he walked away, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." There, but for the grace of God, that would be me! So the next time you open your newspaper or hear the evening news about some horrendous crime, some violent act or some horrible embezzlement or whatever the crime might be, and you're tempted to react in anger or in arrogance, remember, except for the grace of God, that could be you and that could be me. leave the judging to God. In His time and in His way, because I guarantee you it'll be perfect, we need to humbly bow before our God, be grateful for His grace, and allow Him to exercise His justice in His way and in His time.